Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotter in Washington, D.C.
Working days from now, if we do not see real actions that will impact the lives of the working people, we will then proceed on an indefinite industrial action.
The Nigerian Labour Congress, or NLC, plans to embark on a warning strike on Tuesday and Wednesday.
We are calling for their immediate resignation, and this call is based on what we think is their singular contribution to the collapse of our central bank, because it is unheard of that a central bank in 1 year can make a loss of $6 billion.
Arise Ghana plans to embark on a protest Tuesday to demand the resignation or firing of the top leadership of the country's central bank.
Well, I don't blame them thinking whatever they are thinking. But that's the way it is.
And the leader of the Heritage Party dismisses speculation of plans to join Zambia's main opposition party, the Patriotic Front, or PF. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian Labour Congress, NLC, says it's planning a warning strike on Tuesday and Wednesday ahead of an indefinite action in 3 weeks to protest the cost of living after the government scrapped a costly petrol subsidy. The NLC, which represents millions of workers across most sectors of Africa's largest economy, including parts of the oil industry, says this week's action will demonstrate our readiness for the indefinite action due to start on September 21. Unions had been on strike a month ago over their highest inflation in 2 decades, but suspended their action following an offer of talks with the government. But those talks did not result in concessions sufficient to placate organized labor. For more about the planned strike, I reach Emmanuel Ugboaja. He is the General Secretary of the National Labor Congress.
Untold hardship, misery descended on the Nigerian working people and their families. We did reach out, try to draw their attention to the havoc the statement and the subsequent actions have caused on our people. Efforts were made to have conversation around addressing it, but clearly the government had not shown any commitment to dialoguing on the issues. Rather, they feel with time we'll get used to the suffering and live with it. And clearly, this is hurting the people, particularly wage earners that need to be at their duty post every day.
But Emmanuel, recently when you embarked on a strike, you called off the strike after meeting representatives of the government. What happened? Why did you call off the strike? And why are you suddenly deciding that we'll embark on yet another strike?
We reached an agreement. The government completely abdicated its own role with regards to that. That led to the protest march we did about a month ago. And you'll be shocked that arising from that protest march, because we marched to the National Assembly, the Senate gave us a 1 week assurance that they would intervene within 1 week. In fairness to them, they did invite us over within the stipulated time they had stated. And we had a meeting with the Senate president along with his principal officers. And then they promised to convey our fears, our concerns, our agony to the executive. That was to be in addition to what should have been an ongoing discussion or dialogue session with the executive. You'll be shocked that from that time till date, nobody has reached out to us. The month has ended. Workers are still going home with the same miserable sum they had as at May 29th, that this injury got inflicted on them. And there is all we get is bogus pronouncements of trailer loads of rice, trailer loads of wheat, billions of naira being given to state governors but nothing has gotten to the worker. And we can't continue like this.
Do you think the aim of embarking on this two-day strike will pressure the government to meet your demand? Because then people are asking, what's next after this two-day strike? What's next?
The two-day strike is a warning strike. It's an attention-seeking action. We have also, at the next meeting, agreed that 14 working days from now, if we do not see real actions that will impact the lives of the working people, we will then proceed on an indefinite industrial action.
Now, since you announced the decision to embark on the two-day strike beginning next week, some Nigerians on social media platforms say the NLC appear not to be serious because they met representatives of the government and all of a sudden they reversed the decision when no tangible steps, they said, were taken. Yet you agreed to reverse the strike. Now you are embarking on strike again. Why should they take you serious, they say? Your response to that?
It's not whether they take us serious or don't take us serious. He who wears the shoe knows where he pinches in. Those saying that, then definitely are not workers. Workers know what they are suffering. So workers are not going to say, how do they take themselves serious? We're only the mouthpiece of the workers. The working people know what they are suffering. But of course, We are not coup plotters. We don't carry guns.
Emmanuel Ogbuaja is the General Secretary of the National Labour Congress. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Thousands of people reflect on the progress of race relations in America while honoring the 60th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s March on Washington. And U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo hopes to ease economic tensions with China. Listen this weekend on VOA's Issues in the News.
The political pressure group Arise Ghana plans to embark on a protest Tuesday to demand the resignation or firing of Ernest Addison, the governor of the Bank of Ghana, and his two deputies. Joined by opposition groups including the main opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, NDC, and civil society, they accuse the leaders of the central bank of corruption and incompetence, accusations they reject. This after an audit of the bank shows a loss of $6 billion in 2022. The groups say it is not acceptable that such amounts could be lost when the government recently sought a $3 billion loan from the IMF. For more on the protest, I reach Mensah Thompson. He is a leading member of Arise Ghana and an organizer of the protest.
What has catapulted this particular protest? Really, is the publication of the 2022 financial statement of the central bank, which seemed to suggest that our central bank has virtually collapsed. In fact, has indeed collapsed. And it's very strange because you have a central bank that in 2018 collapsed a number of banks in this country because it did not conform to basic financial management regulations and banking regulations and had made certain decisions that had affected the books of those banks. And the central bank collapsed those banks. And so it is shocking that today the central bank has engaged in the same things it collapsed commercial banks for. That has catapulted the Bank of Ghana to make a loss of 60 billion Ghana cedis, which is equivalent to $6 billion in 1 year.
Is the forcing or the removal or the resignation of the Bank of Ghana's governor, Dr. Ernest Addison, and his two deputies one of the core aims of this protest?
Exactly. We are calling for their immediate resignation. And this call is based on what we think is their singular contribution to the collapse of our central bank. Because it is unheard of that a central bank in 1 year can make a loss of $6 billion. It is unheard of in any jurisdiction. Now, what is even more painful is that if you interrogate what is leading to this $6 billion loss, you clinch with abject anger.
Mr. Some people are suggesting that this protest is just a publicity stunt just to score cheap political points to make the government unpopular because the allegations of incompetence against the top leadership of the bank, they said, it's neither here nor there, and that the deputy trade minister is pointing out that the issue of the bank's 60.8 billion Ghana cedis in 2022 fiscal year is just technical.
I'll tell those people to take their time and read the 2022 financial statement, audited financial statement of the central bank, and they can come back and we can have a very thorough conversation on whether this is just to score any political points. In any case, Arise Ghana is not a political party. We are not engaged in politics. We are engaged in public advocacy in the interest of the ordinary Ghanaian. And so, just like last year, when we put about 50,000 Ghanaians on the streets to protest against the economic hardship, the reckless borrowing and spending of the government, it's in that same vein that today we are calling on the governor of the central bank and the deputy and the two deputy governors to resign from their positions. There is nowhere in the world, no corporation, that a managing director will make a loss of $6 billion in 1 year and still keep their job.
The police want to stop the protest. What is the latest development? Will the protest still proceed as planned?
As far as we are concerned, we are having our protest on the 5th of September. We have engaged the people. What we have done, what the police have done, is to go to court to file an application for injunction. Sorry, on Monday, the case is going to be heard at the High Court. The High Court is going to decide whether to grant the police application for injunction or not. But we are determined that the case we've put forth before the court and the affidavits that we filed in opposition to the motion of the police is adequate enough to convince the court, to convince any reasonable court to deny the injunction motion of the police.
Mensa Thompson is a leading member of Arise Ghana and an organizer of the protest. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. In Sierra Leone, Information Minister Chen Oba says visa restrictions imposed by the U.S. are not fair. This after Washington announced visa restrictions on those responsible for undermining the recent general election in Sierra Leone. Abdul Fatoma, a leading human rights activist and the executive director for the group called Campaign for Human Rights and Development International, says reaction has been mixed. He tells me that while the government appears to be displeased with the visa restrictions, supporters of the main opposition, All People's Congress or APC, are happy.
Well, there is a mixed reaction to the announcement from the U.S. Secretary of State and to the U.S. Embassy in Freetown. But Sierra Leone, with these visa restrictions, with this particular administration, it's not new, Peter. This happened again in 2017, where Sierra Leone, Guinea, and other countries were put on restricted list of government officials because of their failing to return people who the U.S. government consider as people who have overstayed their visa. They're living in the U.S. illegally, and then the U.S. government and the Sierra Leone government work through their diplomatic means and resolve that issue without the public knowing anything out of it. So it is a wait-and-see situation. Opposition supporters, sympathizers are actually celebrating, you know, such statement from the Secretary of State.
The names were not mentioned as part of it, but do you have an idea of those who will be caught up in this net?
You know, since after the election, all eyes have been concentrated to the election management bodies, you know, and the security. But when you read the letter, it go more further. People who are responsible or complicit with, you know, the outcome of the elections in the manner in which the Americans and also the Europeans think that it was not free and fair and credible. Well, the African Union and also the ECOWAS said otherwise, you know, towards that election. So the U.S. government, through their ambassador, continue re-echoing, you know, the lack of trust, the lack of confidence, you know, in the outcome of the elections. He said that, you know, in several tweets, and also he made mention of that during, you know, one of his, you know, farewell interview with the local radio station.
Now, Abdul, do you think this will serve as a deterrent?
Yeah, that might be the agenda, but that may not be the outcome at the end of the day, because we have been seeing this happening across Africa. And similar statement has been issued against, you know, people who were responsible for the outcome of those elections. And we still continue seeing similar pattern repeating itself. Like, for example, you know, you can go to Rwanda and see the same man continue winning presidency. You can go to Uganda, you know, the same man continue winning presidency. You can go to Cameroon, the same man continue winning presidency. You know, it happened in Nigeria, and now the U.S., also, they are doing business with Nigeria. Even though immediately after Nigeria election, they also issue out, you know, a similar letter, similar statement, similar restriction. But then they turn around working. I mean, these are just diplomatic work. And sometimes the citizens of this country who want to see the actual democracy at work, you know, they feel relieved when they receive such news. But then at the end of the day, the U.S., in their own interest, diplomatic interest, they will drop this issue without even bringing, you know, it to the notice of the citizens. So, I mean, this is happening across the region. And so it will get to some time and people will not treat it serious. But the objective is like that, but the outcome is not like that.
Abdul Fatoma is a leading human rights activist and the executive director for the group called Campaign for Human Rights and Development International. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. In Zambia, the leader of the Heritage Party has dismissed speculation of plans to join the main opposition party, the Patriotic Front, or PF. Chishala Kateka also called on Zambians and the institutions of government to be respectful to former President Edgar Lungu, who is the only living former president of the Southern African country. This after Kateka paid a courtesy visit to the former president at his residence in the capital, Lusaka. The visit is generating increasing debate, with some speculating that it was aimed as a first step for Madam Kateka to form an alliance with the PF before the next general election. For more reaction and the latest political development, I reach Chishala Kateka in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Decided to make a courtesy call because what we have seen in Zambia is when you have an outgoing president, the current one seems to start persecuting the previous one for one reason or another. So you find that a previous president is ostracized rather than being given the respect that is due to them. It's like there's a sort of a competition. So as New Heritage Party, our party decided to pay a courtesy call because we have seen how the previous president has been, and his family, they've been quite badly treated. I would say that the meeting went very well. We found the former president in high spirits with his wife. We sat with the wife and the president for quite a while, just chatting about things generally.
So basically, you want him to be treated with respect as a statesman, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. We need to break this cycle of treating former presidents with disdain. We need to, somebody's got to break that at some point. You know, we can't keep having politics of vengeance, politics of breaking down what has been built in order to build your own in Africa. Or let me be more specific, in Zambia, we've really got to start developing our country, and we've got to have a foundation and build on that foundation, rather than breaking it down just because you can.
When the pictures of your courtesy visit went round, it's gone viral on social media platforms, by the way, people were wondering and were asking, is Madam Kateka going to join forces with the former ruling party, the Patriotic Front, for which reason she went to visit the former president? What is your response to that?
Well, I don't blame them thinking whatever they are thinking, but that's the way it is. There was a time that one of the PF MPs passed away in Kabwe, and it was a huge funeral. There were so many people, I didn't have time to go and pay my condolences to the same former head of state. But as we were driving back to Lusaka, we happened to meet at an eating place. You know, we all stopped at this place in Chisamba. And yeah, so we greeted each other. His wife was there and my team were there. Oh, and everybody says, you see, now they are going to start working together. So they will always put a spin to make things really, really sound exciting. But we went to pay a courtesy call.
Mm. So what is the message here to the people of Zambia as you paid a courtesy call to the former president, who many are saying could come back and compete in an election? So what is the message here?
Well, the message is that we need to value our resources. We need to respect our former heads of state. Even this current one, when he leaves office, we must respect him and value him, because each and every head of state brings a certain something to the presidency. So we you know, as New Heritage Party, we want to recognize that and really help bring that sort of respect to the office. Whosoever came up with the constitution saw wisdom in forming that office, then let's give respect to the office of the former head of state. Let's give respect to the head of state. We need, look at what happens in America. They don't throw out the presidents and push them under the bus. But this is what we seem to do. As a result of that, we have combative politics, unnecessary politics that does not unite the company. It merely serves to divide the nation. And when you are divided, you cannot think together collectively and pull in the same direction. So we are saying the time has come that we must start to pull in the same direction and tap into that resource rather than casting it out.
Chishala Kateka is the leader of the Zambian Opposition Heritage Party. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. The Ugandan National Teachers Union says President Yoweri Museveni's directive to increase the salaries of heads of secondary schools and their deputies who specialize in science will increase tensions among the teachers. The directive follows a report from the education minister that salaries of head teachers and their deputies have not been increased. But the teachers union says the president should have increased the pay for all teachers instead of being selective, a move they say has created low morale. The non-science teachers, including arts teachers, had recently called on the government to increase their salaries by 100% this year. Philbert Baguma is the general secretary of the Ugandan National Teachers Union. He tells me that President Museveni's latest directive to increase the salaries of only head teachers and their deputies who specialize in science is disappointing.
Yes, we have seen the lesson. And this is making the bad situation worse, because what was done to divide the teachers alongside the subject is the same thing now that has gone to the head teachers. And therefore, we need prayers for the education of the Ugandan children, because this is further ditching the education system in the country.
Why do you think such is going to happen? Shouldn't you be pleased that he has seen a problem and he's trying to fix it?
That is not fixing a problem. It is only creating a problem. Because already the division in the teachers, amongst the teachers, is making the working environment very hostile. Now, bringing on board the head teachers and deputy head teachers is not solving the problem. Instead of now correcting the error that was made, they are further entrenching the divide and rule, which will not create room for value for money, but only make the situation was and endangering the situation of the learners in the education system.
But he said he received a letter from the First Lady, who is also the education minister, about this disparity, and he has addressed it. The question is, people are asking, why wouldn't yourself and your organization try to engage the First Lady, who is also the education minister, to help address some of your concerns or take the matter up to the president?
What didn't we do in terms of engaging them? We had first session, we had letters written, and they chose to take their decision. Which decision is a decision to actually take the education system into the high dependence level, because now public service is divided completely, and you cannot talk of service delivery when the workers are in such a stressful environment that does not support them to do their work as they are expected to do.
So, Philbert, how are you handling this issue of division? That you said the president's latest action will further make the matter worse. How are you handling these among members of your organization who are receiving different things?
Well, first of all, it is not the problem of the workers who are receiving the enhancement. That needs to be very clear, because for them, they have been given. And therefore, we cannot say, why are you receiving? When they give you, you receive. But what we are telling our members and what we are emphasizing is that we should not be victims of this kind of divide and rule. We should remain united as the teaching fraternity, and we must advocate and continue to tell government that when things don't work out, they should not blame anybody, but blame themselves for their inaction and deciding not to listen to the voices that we are giving them the right direction.
So what do you think is the best way forward to address this disparity that you have been talking about? What do you think is the best way forward?
The best way forward is government to look for money and enhance salaries for those teachers of primary, those teachers of arts and humanities who did not get the enhancement, so that there is harmony at the work, and then we serve the innocent learners of this country who have a right to education like any other person.
Philbert Baguma is the General Secretary of the Ugandan National Teachers Union. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. ID for Africa, an international NGO, is calling on the United Nations to adopt September 16 as an International Identity Day. This, the group says, marks UN Sustainable Development Goal 16.9, which calls for a state identity for all individuals by 2030. To commemorate the day, ID for Africa plans to organize a live virtual broadcast. A panel comprising identification experts will address why inclusion appears to remain a major challenge for so many people across Africa. Members of the panel will make recommendations to address the problem. ID for Africa, which was established in 2014, aims to help develop robust ecosystems in the service of development and humanitarian action. For more about plans to encourage more digital identification across Africa, I spoke with Joseph J. Atik. He is the executive chairman of ID for Africa.
What is happening in the world goes beyond digital identity. It is an entire digital transformation. It's a reworking of the way we work, the way we live, the way we interact, the way we pay, the way we share data. So this whole fourth industrial revolution relies on transforming all aspects of life and enabling more in the digital domain. And of course, Africa is no exception. Africa needs to guarantee a bright future for its people, especially the young people who are now constitute the largest group in Africa on the continent. And therefore, there is significant interest in digital transformation in general. And obviously, at the heart of digital transformation, there is always a need for digital identity, because you need to know who you are dealing with in order to enable them to engage in transactions and interactions.
So why digital? What are the key advantages of digital ID?
So productivity is number one. So digital economies lead to massive productivity. They lead to economies at a distance, and they allow you to bypass the lack of infrastructure, physical infrastructure, because they allow you to transact at a distance. We believe digital platforms and digital identity can lead to better inclusion, because people in the remote areas could be included because it's easier to give them a mobile phone with a digital identity than it is to build massive highways and have goods and services being connected to them in that manner. So the value proposition is very clear. And of course, the whole world has been moving in that direction, but it got accelerated with the COVID pandemic. Countries that had digital infrastructure and digital identity were able to provide people who were locked down or unable to go to work with cash transfers, with some assistance in order so they can survive the pandemic.
Now, Dr. Atik, we are coming up on the ID Day, September 16th. Remind our audience what this is about briefly.
Yes. Identity Day is a day which we commemorate every year on the, as you said, 16th September, because it is a reminder for us that we have an asset that's very valuable to us, and that's our human identity. We called for the recognition of 16th September as Identity Day in 2018 in Abuja. And we basically called upon the countries to recognize that day as a way to sensitize the public, as a way to also reaffirm their commitment to leaving no one behind, to giving them identity, etc. So every year, more and more countries and more organizations join forces to commemorate that day.
So I know your organization, ID for Africa, has been helping African countries in their journeys towards inclusive and responsible identity programs. Recently, you had the annual general meeting in Kenya. Talk to me briefly about the outcome of it.
The agenda was focused on accelerating how you deploy digital identity by looking at it as a public infrastructure. And so some of the most visible things that happened at that meeting, we've had about 800 government delegates, and there was a clear hunger for building capacity. It felt like many of these governments and these representatives of government recognized that they are running out of time, and they had to come learn how to quickly deploy responsible ID systems. We've also had President Ruto, president of Kenya, who came and spoke as part of the speaker lineup. He spoke for 40 minutes about the importance of digital identity in the African context and how we need a political commitment to ensure that this doesn't waver and this does not become a secondary priority in Africa. So it was nice to see the political will. And the agenda was very productive in the sense that we came up with several recommendations which we don't have time to take on, but we will continue them and explore them on our webinar series, which we call the Livecast.
Joseph J. Atik is the executive chairman of ID for Africa. He spoke with me from the French capital, Paris. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley. That will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Youth from African Collection. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The draw for the inaugural Africa Football League quarterfinals in Cairo has produced mouth-watering ties between some of the continent's biggest clubs. Tanzania's Simba SC will host Egyptian giant Al Ahly in the first leg of a first quarterfinal on October 20th in the draw conducted on Saturday by Ghana legend Asamoah Gyan and Angolan model Maria Bo.
August. Al Ahly have won a record 11 CAF Champions League titles, with Simba seeking the maiden semi-final appearance in the new AFL. Five-time Champions League winners TP Mazembe of DR Congo will take on Tunisian Cup specialist Esperance in the second quarter-final first leg on October 21. Nigerian outfit Enyimba, the first Nigerian club to win the CAF Champions League in 2003 and 2004, will face Moroccan heavyweights Wydad Casablanca, who have three titles. Petro de Luanda from Angola and Mamelodi Sundowns from South Africa will conclude the quarterfinal matchups. Petro's participation will, however, depend on an appeal they have filed with the Angolan Football Association over a discipline matter. The quarterfinal first leg will take place from October 20th to the 22nd, with a return leg scheduled between October 24th to the 25th to decide the semi-finalist. In marathon news, Ugandan Vitalis Wimoy and Chamoz Viola Munrera were winners in the second edition of the Mark Rwenzori Marathon that took place in the scenic town of Kasese, Uganda on Saturday. The Rwenzori Marathon ranges, known for their breathtaking beauty, provided a stunning backdrop to the marathon, drawing 2,000 participants from 13 countries, including famous international sports commentator Rob Walker.
I can see the potential in this event. It's going to be a big, big part of promoting this area of Uganda going forward, because we need people to know that Uganda has mountains.
Vitalis Kwimoy clocked 2 hours, 17 minutes and 21 seconds to beat second place Bernard Cheptoe, who came in 2 hours, 17 minutes, 22 seconds, while Shatrack Kimayo clocked 2 hours, 17 minutes, 37 seconds to take bronze. Kwimoy said it was indeed a difficult race to win.
The race was too tough because going was a little bit hard, but coming back was a little bit slow. And I'm not used to wear slow. I'm a little bit faster in hill work, in the hill.
In the women's category, Viola Chamoz Murewa won in 2 hours, 49 minutes, 3 seconds. In basketball news, South Sudan earned the nation's first Olympic berth in any sport on Saturday, and did so with a team filled with refugees and the children of refugees from the Water Nation. The Bright Stars, as they are known, won the bid allotted for Africa with a 101-78 victory over Angola, triggering tears and hugs from players as several dozen fans waved the young country's flag. And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There is a general consensus amongst BRIC members that the 15th summit of BRIC group has been successful and see it as a historical event. This is not a hyperbole. During 3 days of consultations, debate, informal sessions, retreat, and bilateral discussions, the BRIC members were frank, clear-thinking, and not hesitant to point out their view of the current international situation. They are in common agreement, one, that they do not want to be a small, inclusive group of member states who have the same views on many issues. For them, the BRIC group is a group of nations who have a shared history of colonialism and imperialism and underdevelopment. It is for this group, for this reason, that the group seeks to be inclusive and to appreciate diverse opinion in harmony, but they do have a common purpose, and they also wish to economize or end underdevelopment and to proceed on a developed stage. They are not worried if the expanded group members do not agree on many international issues. They see this as, in fact, a plus. The members also agreed that they do not agree that there is a system of hierarchical values before which all other states must kowtow. They believe that a world order is not shaped by a small group, but should be the work of the global community. That is why they stress again and again that they believe in multilateralism based on the letter and spirit of the United Nations Charter, which pledged to save mankind from the scourge of war and the maintenance of international peace and security. They express disapproval of the dominance of multilateral organizations of the Western powers, and they want more democratization of these institutions, including the financial institutions. The group members want to stress that they are not in confrontation with the West, and they do not seek to replace existing organizations of like-mindedness. In fact, they would wish for cooperation, and they stressed that in particular the democratization of the Bretton Woods institution. They also made clear that they do not agree that member states of BRICS should choose whom they want to have as their partner and not be told those which should not be their members or their partners. The decision to expand BRICS is a joint one. It is reached by consensus, and it was not haphazard and not sudden. According to the host president, Cyril Ramaphosa, the consultation of the expansion has been going on for a very, very, very long time. And let me add that at the sideline of this summit, the president of China, Xi Jinping, met with a large number of heads of state of African countries in the China-Africa consultation. He expressed China's commitment to work closely with African countries, particularly, he pledged, the plan to industrialize Africa, a long, long expected objective of the African states. And he pledged two programs, one for $10 billion, another for $4 million, that should help this goal and purpose. Let us note that just after the close of the summit, already the airwaves were being filled with those who are not well informed for trying to minimize the importance of the summit. I dare say any careful study of the closing session of the summit will prove that the efforts will be futile. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
She's a good belly dancer. The way you wine, girl, you look so romantic. Like the way how you bake it. The way how you wine, girl, you got me confessing. Oh yeah, yeah. Wait to be your neighbor. I'm on you tonight. I'm loving the way how you doing it right. Yeah, yeah. None of them but they went past you. Slow it down, yeah, slow motion. And I like the way they went for me. You know, say now you be the winner. Wait to be your neighbor. My tattoo, or maybe your name not Fatu, yeah. Or now your name Khadija. Tell me, or make a actually party back.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a person who chases a chicken is due a fall. I'm your host, Peter Cote.